From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. More trouble ahead for Theresa May. The British Prime Minister told the House of Commons today there will be no parliamentary vote tomorrow on her plan for the UK to leave the European Union.
I am determined to do all I can to secure the reassurances this House requires, to get this deal over the line and deliver for the British people. And I commend this statement to the House.
Here's how opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn of the Labour Party responded.
The government has lost control of events and is in complete disarray. Yep. Yes. It's been evident for weeks that the Prime Minister's deal did not have the confidence of this House.
Right.
Yet she ploughed on regardless, reiterating, this is the only deal available.
The main stumbling block continues to be the border between Northern Ireland, which is part of the UK, and the Republic of Ireland, which is in the European Union. Let's bring in BBC political correspondent Rob Watson in London. And Rob, the vote was scheduled for tomorrow, but the Prime Minister acknowledging today she just does not have the support that she needs to get this deal through.
That's right, and I think it's very difficult to see it as anything other than a humiliating climb down for the Prime Minister. I think it's also hard not to see it as a profound deepening of the already deep crisis that Britain is in over Brexit. And, you know, one can get into the sort of nitty-gritty and parliamentary complexities, but in many ways, Peter, this is incredibly simple what's happening, simple and grave at the same time, and that is what you're seeing is that British politicians still cannot agree what to do about the results of the 2016 referendum. It's both as simple, as basic, but also as seismic, and it would seem insoluble as that.
Okay, let's go through some of the options that Theresa May still has on the table. Could she go back to Brussels now and renegotiate the issue of the Irish backstop so that she could bring some skeptical MPs on board?
Well, that's what she's going to try to do, but it seems pretty clear that she's really going to be up against it. I mean, the European Union has said that they won't do that, and incredibly, in a way that sort of is incredibly difficult for the Prime Minister, again, stretches her credibility. She had already said, look, to MPs, this is the best deal that there can be. This can't be renegotiated. So, I mean, she finds herself in an impossible position, but I suspect that's what she might do. That's what she will do. She may get some cosmetic changes, but I'm not sure that there's anything that the European Union could or would agree to that would be a game changer in terms of that political stalemate at home.
We heard from the European Court of Justice today that said the UK could just cancel Brexit without permission from the 27 other members of the European Union. Does that leave the door open for Theresa May to just change her mind, to cancel the divorce? Is that on the table?
Well, it certainly leaves the door open for Britain to do that. I think Theresa May, even though she was on the Remain side of the argument, and even though I think these days people are not entirely sure that they would trust Theresa May on her red lines or any of her positions, which she says to be adamant about, but it seems to me that the one thing that really does drive her is the idea that somehow Britain couldn't go back on the results of the referendum, that no matter how dumb you think it is, and, you know, let's remember most British politicians do think that that Brexit is utterly self-defeating and stupid. She obviously has a particularly personal belief that the vote, as she often puts it, the form of words she uses, that the referendum result has to be honoured. So I can't see a government led by her being prepared to have either a second vote or just writing to the EU and saying, you know what, guys, we've made a horrible mistake. We've changed our minds.
Well, at the same time, time is running out. At the end of March, the UK will crash out of the European Union if there's no deal. How urgent is this getting?
Oh, this is immensely urgent, and the financial markets aren't happy. Britain's two biggest business organisations have said that they are profoundly unhappy. Look, there's no getting away from this. This is the most profound crisis that Britain has faced since the end of the Second World War. I mean, this is not, Peter, an exaggeration. I mean, businesses are crying out, what are we supposed to do? Some businesses are already making plans to leave. Foreign investment has dried up. This is a profound question. It's not just about Britain's membership of the EU. It's so much bigger than that. It's about Britain's role in the world, about the kind of economy it has, national cohesion at home, questions of national identity. And what we're seeing is just how divided British politicians are and about how divided the country is. And, you know, essentially what Theresa May has done today is to kick the can further down the road. But you see, that road, she is running out of road. It's as simple as that, and it's very hard to see anything that changes it.
And she has so many interests to satisfy. Just briefly, chances that she survives this politically?
I just don't know. I don't think anyone would give you good odds. But on the other hand, what's kept her in place so far is that while the Conservative Party certainly doesn't view her as Winston Churchill, they just can't yet agree on what on earth to do to replace her.
Well, there is the old line about a rock in a hard place. It seems like Theresa May is there.
She certainly is. She could not be in a more uncomfortable position. It must be every politician's waking, living nightmare.
The BBC's political correspondent, Rob Watson, in London. Rob, thanks as always.
Thanks.
Well, Democratic Congressman Raul Grijalva and Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke recently locked horns in a bitter and very public war of accusations. Grijalva called on Zinke to resign in light of several ethics investigations. Zinke took to Twitter to slam the Arizona congressman for allegations one of his staff members made last year that he was drunk and created a hostile work environment. Now, this all comes against the backdrop of changing leadership in Congress. Grijalva is set to become the new chair of the House Committee on Natural Resources, the committee that oversees the Department of the Interior, also the committee with the most power over public lands. As the Trump administration and a Republican-controlled Congress have dismantled many Obama-era environmental regulations, Grijalva vows to protect the environment and investigate Zinke. Well, Ali Budner of KRCC spent some time with Grijalva to learn more about his plans.
All along, Raul Grijalva has been one of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke's most vocal critics. Here he is questioning Secretary Zinke on numerous occasions over the last couple of years.
I hope you provide some detailed answers today explaining why spending $138,000 for office doors is a reasonable expense for the public to bear.
And here.
Let's talk about bear's ears. One of the letters that we sent was wanting an accounting.
And again.
Your intention is not to suppress scientific findings that you might disagree with?
Secretary Zinke is currently the subject of at least three ethics investigations. As chair of the House Natural Resources Committee, Grijalva now has the power to push for more transparency in those inquiries. Still, Grijalva believes Zinke is just part of the problem.
I think that if he were to resign or be sent away, that the legacy of kind of turning over Interior to the fossil fuel industry and the extraction industry is not going to go away, so there's still things to look at.
For example,
what I think you can expect is a return to giving prominence to the conservation side that hasn't been there in the last 2 years, and any legislation that continues to rip away at our bedrock environmental laws, we're not going to waste time on it.
Grijalva says instead he plans to focus on issues in Indian country, on protecting wildlife and the Endangered Species Act, preserving public lands, and the elephant in the room, climate change.
Climate change has been scrubbed from the discussion. Peer review has been severely handicapped. Panels of scientists have been eliminated. And you don't talk about climate change, you don't talk about science anymore when you're making decisions.
Representative Grijalva is extremely hostile to oil and natural gas development.
That's Kathleen Sagama, president of the Western Energy Alliance, an industry group. Sagama's not thrilled about a Democrat, specifically a politically progressive one like Grijalva, taking the helm, and as she sees it, stirring things up.
He's extremely hostile to economic development, ranching, mining, timber, any kind of development on federal lands.
She says she's not worried about losing too much ground, though, mainly because of partisan gridlock in Congress.
It's unfortunate that Congress cannot come together and find some compromises on natural resource issues, but that's just the nature of Washington, D.C.
Others, though, have more faith in Grijalva's ability to move things forward.
He has been able to broker deals with Republicans, both in the House and the Senate, to protect the environment.
That's Kieran Suckling. He's the director of the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental nonprofit. He's not a fan of the current chair, Republican Rob Bishop from Utah.
Bishop is really one of the most anti-environmental congressmen in Congress.
Suckling sees Grijalva as an ally, for good reason. Grijalva is on the advisory board of the Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Law Institute and has been vocal about prioritizing the environment. For his part, former committee chair Rob Bishop had this to say in response to the transition. In a written statement, he said, "We look to continue being active next Congress as we move into doubling down on President Trump's top-notch environment and energy policies. Whether he'll be able to do that with Grijalva at the helm is an open question, but Grijalva is hopeful there will be bipartisanship on the committee. Still, regarding common ground with the former chair..."
"We both like baseball. I don't know if we... if we sometimes see the sky the same color, politically speaking, probably rarely, but, you know, it's part of what we need in this Congress is a level of civility and respect for one another's opinions. He's shown that to me, and I hope I've shown that to him."
Raul Grijalva is set to take leadership of the House Committee on Natural Resources next month. For Here and Now, I'm Allie Budner.
And Allie's story comes to us from the Mountain West News Bureau.
If you're one of the nearly 10 million people in this country with a serious mental illness, you'll probably understand the struggle of our next guest. Taylor Neiman lives with bipolar disorder. It forced her to drop out of college with $20,000 of debt for a degree that she's been unable to finish. She's only 25 years old, but already it's devastated her career and her financial life. Taylor Neiman lives in Portland, Oregon, and she joins me now. Taylor, thanks for being brave enough to talk about this. I know you've had a hard time keeping a job because you've needed to get treatment for bipolar disorder.
Yeah, exactly. And or even the fact that I needed care, but I would just quit the job and then, you know, move to a different apartment, tried all these things besides getting care and not actually addressing the root cause, which was the mental illness. And so now that I can do that, I've actually finally found a job and a situation where if I need to back off from work and kind of come in as needed, I can do that. I have the freedom to do that. So I'm very lucky in that regard.
Sure. And your job now is working for a solar company. I understand you do some canvassing to try to get people to sign up for solar energy. Is that right?
Yeah. So we do everything from home shows to calling to mostly door knocking, even when it's super chilly out. But I also make commission, which really helps. So the fact that I'm working, you know, sometimes 10 hours a week can still be okay because I get commission based on how many appointments I get to sit. So finding a job that pays more than minimum wage sometimes can really help.
You know, the Americans with Disabilities Act makes it illegal for employers to fire their workers because of a mental illness, as long as you can do the essential functions of the job. So in some ways you're protected, but I'm sure it is still kind of scary to go into a new work situation and decide whether you're going to tell your boss. What's your strategy for that?
Yeah, that's definitely something I've always faced. A lot of places I've worked, you get allotted amount of, you know, sick days. And so that's part of the reason I've always quit jobs is because I'm about to get fired. Because I've missed so many days of work, and at my current job, you know, my manager right off the bat, maybe after like a month or so, kind of told me, "Hey, you know, if you're having any issues, if anything's going on and you need to talk to me, open door policy, like you come to me and tell me what's going on." And so I felt comfortable.
And you told your boss?
Yeah, I did. So I told my boss that, you know, I suffer from bipolar disorder, you know, I love work and I want to come to work, but some days I just can't get out the door for that reason.
How much money are you making a year in that job?
So I just started, but because it's commission, I'd say I make anywhere from $15,000 to $20,000, but with the potential to make more.
How has your mental illness and that struggle with it just affected your personal finances? Because that's not a lot of money to live on.
Yeah, it really isn't. I've been able to manage things now by opening which I don't advise really, but, you know, opening credit cards and being able to live off those.
Oh, I hear financial planners all over the country sort of shaking in their boots right now. But do you pay that off every month or do you go deeper in debt?
So, I mean, yeah, you go deeper in debt, and then once hopefully your life has gotten back together, then you can start making payments towards it again.
How much credit card debt do you have?
Oh, probably at this point, close to $7,000 or $8,000. And that's not me alone. That's between me and my partner combined.
But it's in addition to the $20,000 you have in student loan debts.
Yes, in addition to that, and in addition to my partner's $50,000-$60,000.
You're 25 years old. I'm sure you have many dreams for yourself. How has this mental illness changed your expectations for your career?
It really has. I think part of it too, and this might be a little bit of what being bipolar is you get these ideas in your head, and you get really passionate about things, and it's kind of like go, 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 and you want to do this, and you want to do that, and so you get like hyper focused on things. So, you know, when I had first started college, I wanted to be an archaeologist, and then I wanted to be an artist, and I just couldn't stay focused on one thing. And then, you know, I wanted to be a hairstylist, and I actually completed that, and I did that for a little bit, and then I changed again. I think, like, I just can't stay focused on anything. So that's my problem, is I want to do too many things, and I don't know what I want to do most of the time, if that makes sense.
That's Taylor Neiman, who is living with bipolar disorder and speaking to us about how that has affected her job prospects and her career. Taylor, thanks very much for speaking with us, and good luck to you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's turn now to Susan Goldberg. She's a psychologist, a lawyer, and an assistant professor of psychology at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. She's looked at the challenge of managing mental illness and work. Dr. Goldberg, Taylor is in a tough spot. What would you advise her to do?
So we did research on people with psychiatric disabilities, and we found that the experts all had divergent ideas of to disclose or not to disclose for employment. Certain people, usually attorneys, said never disclose. And vocational rehab people said always disclose. And what we found that people with psychiatric disabilities did is figure out their own way, because it didn't work with what the experts said.
Huh.
And some people chose to disclose, some people chose never to disclose. But what I found was generally the most successful was selective disclosure of person, place, time, and content.
Hmm.
So selective disclosure of person would mean that you really trust this supervisor or this HR person that you disclose to. Selective disclosure of place has to do with the kind of entity you're working for. If it's in a small business, you may not want to disclose. A large business that knows about ADA, you may find it helpful to disclose. Selective disclosure of time means deciding when to disclose. Some people only disclosed immediately before they needed an accommodation. So they may have never disclosed for years, and then they needed to take time off, like Taylor said she needed, and then they would disclose at that point. And selective disclosure of content is a really cool one. It's not disclosing the whole thing, like not saying I have bipolar disorder or I have schizophrenia, because people even now stigmatize people with such disabilities. But to say I have a problem and I take some pills, or I'm a little anxious and I take some pills. So you could limit the amount of content you share while still asking for an accommodation. And I think that's what would be best for Taylor.
Taylor said that she trusted her boss when she went to her supervisor and disclosed, and it went well for her. Do you find that employers usually are accommodating if you've done it strategically?
I can't say yes or no. Every case is different. We had stories like one woman told the HR person as she was supposed to, and the secretary to the HR person had to get involved by passing it to the supervisor of the HR person, and the secretary then told everybody. Mm. So it's really, there's such variety on how trusting you could be with someone. And sometimes they don't even know that they're violating a trust. They may just say, hey, I heard that you're sick, or I heard that you were hospitalized. And they may not even realize how offensive that is to some people and what problems that causes. So I wouldn't say that people are always accommodating or never accommodating. I think it's really it really depends on the individual.
Big picture, I wonder what you make of all this, because managing a mental illness is difficult enough, but then you also have to manage the impacts to your professional and financial life, and that in and of itself can just add so many stresses. Can you just comment on how hard this can be?
It can be very hard. And then another aspect of it is if you don't disclose, you feel like you're hiding a secret or you have no one to share it with at work. So there are many aspects of it. But I also think people who stay in low-wage jobs for fear of going into a higher-wage job also feel stressed by not rising to their full potential. So that there are people who have the potential to do better and are just afraid, and sometimes vocational rehabilitation people scare them and say, oh, you can't do a higher level job. And I don't think that's wise. I think people should aim as high as they can aim and just find a way to manage. Not to say that it's easy, but it's going to be stressful at a low wage for reasons of having a low wage, and it's going to be stressful at a high wage.
Dr. Susan Goldberg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And let us know if this resonates with your own story. Did you tell your boss about your mental illness? How did it go? Did you decide not to tell your boss? And if you're an employer, how did you handle it? We're at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Carlos Ghosn, the one-storied chair of Nissan Motor Company, was indicted today in Tokyo for understating his pay by about $43 million between 2010 and 15. It's shocking news about the man who once earned the names 7-Eleven and Mr. Fix-It for the tireless work ethic that rescued Nissan from the brink of bankruptcy two decades ago. He also forged a powerful alliance of Nissan, Renault, and Mitsubishi. He even had a popular manga comic book series made about his life. Well, if these allegations are true, they may need to write a sequel. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money and the podcast Better Off, joins us now. Jill, first off, tell us more about what Ghosn and Nissan are accused of.
Well, the prosecutors in Tokyo are alleging that he conspired to report just about half of his compensation for the 5 years ended March of 2015. And although this was not part of the formal charges right this minute, there also could be additional charges for the 3 years ending March of 2018. And if you put those 8 years together, it looks like understatements of about 80 million bucks. Mm. And I should also note, it's not just Ghosn. It is also his deputy who is sitting in jail right now, I should say. Yeah. And they will be in jail for until this thing gets adjudicated.
Is that what they mean when they say Nissan was indicted as well? Because people had to know that he was doing this.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the two individuals are facing up to 10 years in prison. Nissan faces a maximum fine of up to 700 million yen. That translates into $6.25 million for each year of incorrect financial reports. So, you know, tallying it up over 8 years, it's 50 million bucks. I should also note that Japan has a very high conviction rate. More than 97% of criminal cases in Japan result in a guilty verdict.
Okay, look, I would say, given that, you know, maybe 10 years in jail, why would he do this? Isn't it enough to be a multimillionaire? But I think we might need a psychologist for that. But why is it so important to know what someone's actually making?
Well, I mean, look, this is enormously important because if you're understating your compensation, what else are you understating? And I think that this really does call into question, what else did Ghosn do? Remember, he was the chairman and CEO of Renault, the chairman of Nissan, the chairman of Mitsubishi, and the CEO of the Dutch entity that acts as the bridge between Nissan and Renault. He was seriously considered like the god of the global automotive world.
Well, we mentioned this alliance between Nissan, Mitsubishi, and Renault. After Ghosn's arrest on November 19th, Nissan and Mitsubishi dumped him as chair. Renault has kept him on for now. What does this mean for the alliance, and how are the markets reacting?
I think that each of the companies is down 2-3% on the announcement of the indictment. But this really does call into question as well what happens in corporate governance when one guy is so much part of a company's fabric. So I would imagine that there are going to be some names floated for these companies, but I almost could bet that from the Japanese side, they want a Japanese national in charge of their companies that are such big parts of their economy.
Well, we'll keep watching. Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News, host of Jill on Money. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's just, why isn't $15 million enough? Why do you have to add? It's here and now. Last week, a British parliamentary committee released the latest Facebook bombshell, internal emails that showed ruthless Facebook executives collecting user data and allowing Airbnb, Lyft, and Netflix access to it while denying it to competitors. Then COO Sheryl Sandberg recently had to admit she knew the company hired Definers Public Affairs. That's the Dirty Tricks political consulting firm. She wanted to take down people like George Soros. And of course, founder Mark Zuckerberg long denied Facebook was used by Russians to interfere in the U.S. election, and that Facebook had a role in the ethnic cleansing in Myanmar, and allowed a political data firm linked to President Trump to have access to personal information about tens of millions of people. But as New York Times media columnist Jim Rutenberg wrote recently, Facebook deals with these crises by promising to do better, waiting until the outrage dies down, and then going on with business as usual. And he writes, we should have known. It was all predicted in the 2010 movie The Social Network and the book that was based on, The Accidental Billionaires by Ben Mezrich. The movie, from Aaron Sorkin, starred Jesse Eisenberg as Zuckerberg, a student at Harvard hacking into the university's young internet system to create FaceMash, posting pictures of girls to compare their hotness.
Unfortunately, Harvard doesn't keep a public centralized Facebook, so I'm going to have to get all the images from the individual houses that people are in. Let the hacking begin.
Jim Rutenberg's column is The Facebook Movie Told Us What We Needed to Know About Mark Zuckerberg, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you went back to see the movie. You encourage all of us to do so. But when you first saw it in 2010, you thought what?
I mean, my takeaway at the time was, yeah, this young Zuckerberg is a jerk, but hey, he's sticking it to the man and he's upending the system. And if you remember, the kind of the foils of the movie for him are the jockey, rich guy, Winklevi, the Winklevoss twins, whose idea he kind of, you know, seems pretty strong case can be made that he stole or was influenced by them and starts Facebook after his infamous FaceMash incident.
Well, and yet you still were rooting for him. I have to say, I wasn't, primarily because of the way he treated women. You know, that first FaceMash, the relationship he had with a girlfriend that was in the film, seemed pretty misogynistic at the time.
That is true, and I would always be offended by that kind of behavior. But it kind of wasn't what I took away from the movie when I thought back on it. You know, I think we've all forgotten that that was in his past. And shame on me for not remembering it, because it's in the DNA of the company, whether he wants to admit it or not.
When you watch this movie, there was sort of a rocky aspect to it. This kid who had seemed to have some trouble communicating with others, kind of nerdy, battling the good-looking Winklevi twins, who, by the way, as you right now, look a whole lot better in your second viewing. What made you want to go back and see the film again?
Well, for that very reason, you know, I was like, God, you know what, that movie, remember the Winklevi? Maybe they were us. You know, they were the first to be run over. So I don't feel too sorry for the Winklevi. They've made a lot of money. Now they're in Bitcoin and speculating on values there. But they ran into this kid, and he ends up steamrolling them, and a lot of people have been in the same position since.
Let's listen to a scene. Both the twins were played by Armie Hammer in the film. Let's listen.
Okay, well, we have something that we've been working on for a while, and we think it's great. It's called the Harvard Connection. You create your own page, interest, bio, friends, pics, and then people can go online, see your bio, request.
Yeah, how is that different from MySpace or Friendster?
Harvard.edu. Harvard.edu is the most prestigious email address in the country. The whole site's kind of based on the idea that girls, not to put anything in delicately.
Girls want to go with guys who go to Harvard.
Girls want to go with guys who go to Harvard. Look, Zuckerberg seems to be working with them, funded by another friend of his, but he comes up with his own version. In the lawsuits that ensue, he says, well, I didn't take any of their code. He settles those lawsuits. Facebook becomes bigger than ever. And by the way, dumps that friend who was his funder along the way, too.
Yeah, and one thing I want to say here is this is a movie, of course, but the main facts of the plot are true, and that did happen, and there were big settlements. And I'd also say that this was a long time ago for Zuckerberg. Then again, I'd like to think I haven't done those things to the people who I was working with, and most people would say the same, so it resonates very much today.
Well, you write, the film's portrayal of a budding tech magnate as someone more interested in growing his creation than in who might be hurt by it has stood the test of time. Do you see that changing recently?
I really don't know. The jury is certainly still out. You referenced this in the beginning here, that we're now learning that Facebook, after saying earlier this year, we hear the criticism, we want to fix things, we, after grudgingly acknowledging, now wholeheartedly acknowledge that we weren't up to the job here in keeping disinformation off our platform from foreign state actors. Let's not forget ethnic cleansing campaigns in Myanmar. We understand we want to fix this. Yet at the same time, they were enlisting a opposition research firm to go after critics who really were making the same criticism that Facebook said it heard and understood in a lot of these cases, and among them George Soros, who has funded research into Facebook and the way it helps hate spread for years and years and years and years before a lot of us were talking about it.
Mm. Well, and you also quote Eli Pariser. His 2011 book was The Filter Bubble, and his notion was that Zuckerberg had to hold fast to this idea that social media was a force for good. I mean, it was only in 2017 that he said that it might fragment our shared sense of reality. And doesn't that get us to what's at the crux of this here? That Facebook, after so many sharp elbows to get where he is, there's a chance, it's still an outside chance, but there's a chance that the entire thing collapses because it's kind of a house of cards. And because they can't fix things like people taking over elections or running hate campaigns through this thing. It's like that scene in Fantasia where Mickey Mouse has gotten the Sorcerer's Apprentice has gotten magic he can't handle, and the buckets and the brooms are multiplying. I mean, is there a chance that a lot of this defensiveness is that they're possibly looking at that?
Their stock is taking somewhat of a hit, but we've seen this happen before, and Facebook and other tech stocks bounce back. But they are definitely worried. And I think what you see in this pattern that we're talking about is this acknowledgement from Zuckerberg that, oh, maybe I'm naive or I screwed up. I'm going to fix it. I screwed up. I'm going to fix it. And what he's trying to say through all of it always is, I mean well here, and sometimes we just – things happen that we're not expected or girding for. And That's wearing thin to me now because of the defensiveness, because of the longevity of the pattern that, again, is sitting right there in the movie, but more importantly, sitting in reality years earlier. It's just the same thing over and over. So how many bonus points does he get, or how much wiggle room does he get for being naive or overlooking things or not thinking about the implications of this tool he's created, to his credit, that is changing the world, not to his credit, the ill effects of this that we're all now living with.
And the other thing you can add to that list, naive, not sure, is being completely sure of himself and arrogance. Here's another scene from the film. One of the attorneys for the Winklevoss twins is taking Zuckerberg to task for not listening to him.
You don't think I deserve your attention?
I think if your clients want to sit on my shoulders and call themselves tall, they have a right to give it a try. But there's no requirement that I enjoy sitting here listening to people lie. You have part of my attention. You have the minimum amount. The rest of my attention is back at the offices of Facebook, where my colleagues and I are doing things that no one in this room, including and especially your clients, are intellectually or creatively capable of doing.
I don't have time for this. I'm a genius.
Well, he kind of said that to Congress earlier this year when neither he nor Sheryl Sandberg wanted to appear themselves in the first round of congressional hearings they sent in their lawyers. They finally showed up. It was grudging. Congress did not bathe itself in glory. The members clearly, many of them didn't really understand the technology. So maybe some disdain could have been warranted or vindicated in his mind. But we see these flashes, and we kind of saw one now with this latest batch of news out of the British Parliament, right, where Facebook has answered that new allegation that Facebook was sharing personal data with advertisers with a very defensive, this is unwarranted, there's a lawsuit behind this that they don't recognize, and this is out of context and not true. And maybe that will end up being the case. We'll see what more leg they want to show to prove that. But again, the pattern back to face mash.
Again, that's New York Times media columnist Jim Rutenberg. Jim, have you heard from anyone at Facebook after that column?
Yeah, I'm regularly speaking with people there. And to a large degree, we agree to disagree, especially when it comes to their use of opposition research firms to go after their critics.
Leave it at that. Jim, thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Last month, a Chinese researcher claimed he had used the gene editing technique CRISPR to modify the DNA of a human embryo. Scientists around the world protested, saying it was unethical and a highly premature use of the technology. But it is a different story when it comes to using CRISPR to modify food. GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, have been common on American farms for decades, and now a whole new generation of gene-edited foods are on the way to the supermarket. Kerry Goldberg of WBUR reports.
They just went into soil 2 days ago, so that's why they're so small right now.
Seedlings sprout in clumps of peat at a lab in Woburn, just north of Boston. Foot-high stalks rise from quart pots of soil under bright grow lights. Both familiar sights to some gardeners, but no amateur gardener has ever done what research associate Kieran Ryan is doing. He's shining ultraviolet light on grains of rice in a petri dish to see which ones glow red.
Some of these seeds glow and some of them don't. There's one in the middle there that doesn't glow.
Ryan and his boss, Ollie Peoples, want rice grains that don't glow, a visual signal that the CRISPR process to edit one of their genes is complete. Peoples is the CEO of Yield 10, an ag tech company that's aiming to make major crops like rice much more productive. He portrays the company's work as part of a rising wave of gene editing that could lead to another green revolution, like the huge leap in grain production back in the 50s and 60s. But he says gene editing could affect agriculture across the board, not just yields.
It's everything all the way down to flavor, appearance, you know, the non-browning apple. Lettuce that doesn't wilt.
For millennia, plant breeding just meant selection. Farmers would choose the better plants and sow those seeds. The 20th century saw the advent of a new method, mutation breeding.
Which means let's take this rice and irradiate it to cause mutations and see if that gets us something.
Professor Tim Griffin is chair of agriculture, food, and environment at the Friedman School at Tufts University. He says mutation breeding has been used mainly in big crops like wheat, corn, rice, and soy. Then, in the 90s, came the first generation of GMO crops. Opposition to GMOs has focused largely on the increased herbicide use they enable. Nevertheless, in the U.S., corn, soybeans, cotton, and sugar beets are now overwhelmingly GMO. Griffin gives one classic example.
They took a gene from a bacteria that lives in the soil. They got it into corn, and then that corn was resistant to glyphosate, which is a weed killer. That exchange of the gene is not something that you would just expect to happen in nature because on one hand it's a corn plant and on the other it's a soil microbe.
The biggest difference between GMO crops and the new gene-edited foods is that CRISPR is generally used like a molecular scissors, snipping out genes rather than inserting new ones from other organisms. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced this spring that it won't regulate most CRISPRed crops because they could have been produced with conventional breeding. But exactly how the gene-edited crops, and animals for that matter, should be regulated remains very much in play.
It's a very new and unproven technology that needs a lot more work before it's turned loose in the marketplace.
Steve Gilman is the policy coordinator for the Northeast Organic Farming Association. He's among those who challenge the notion that CRISPRed crops should be regulated less because they pose fewer risks.
There should be an orderly, transparent process for what goes into our food supply. And for a long time, this has not been the case. It's been ruled by big food, and this is just another case of the technology surging forward in the search of profits.
But at a recent Boston conference on CRISPR, a prominent organic farmer, Klaus Martens, expressed qualified support for gene editing.
I think there are some uses of CRISPR that would be fully compatible, in my opinion, with the goals of organic agriculture. There are some others that I think would not be compatible, and I would hope that as an industry we could go forward and discuss the different uses.
The devil's in the details.
Gregory Jaffe at the nonprofit Center for Science in the Public Interest says the risks and benefits of gene editing have to be examined on a case-by-case basis. Jaffe is a member of the new National Coalition for Responsible Gene Editing in Agriculture. With industry support, the coalition is trying to work out guiding principles for developers of gene-edited crops and animals.
We should actually look at this in a science evidence-based manner, not just applying old laws to a new technology, like fitting a square peg into a round hole.
In the coming years, you'll likely start seeing CRISPRed foods on the shelves, but you may not always know you're seeing them. Jaffe believes a pending federal law about disclosing and labeling what's called bioengineered food probably will not include gene-edited foods. But some CRISPRed foods may advertise their gene-edited benefits. Jaffe says a Minnesota company called Calixt is expected to start selling heart-healthier soybean oil in 2019.
If you were a consumer, you'd have to look hard to find this oil. But the point being that there are products that are moving to the farm and to the food supply.
Gene-edited food is stirring up great excitement and great uncertainty. But one thing seems certain. CRISPRed foods are coming. For Here and Now, I'm Carrie Goldberg.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter Odak.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.